Bluegrass Jam Along is proud to be sponsored by Collings Guitars and Mandolins, each and every one built from the sound up in Austin, Texas. This episode is also brought to you by Peghead Nation, the home of roots music instruction. If you want to improve your playing, join me and thousands of other pickers getting better every day at pegheadnation.com.
Hey folks, this is Marcella Dance, and you're listening to Bluegrass Jam Along, the podcast for anyone and everyone who plays bluegrass.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Bluegrass Jam Along. I have a guest for you on this episode, and it is Marcel R. Dance, who's better known to most of you, I would imagine, as Marcel from Lessons with Marcel, website and YouTube channel. Most of you will know Marcel, I'm sure. But if you don't, he, for the past 6 years, has run a great online community of bluegrass players. He teaches, he transcribes, he shows people how to play famous breaks from songs. It's just such a huge resource he's got there. And he teaches with such a sense of fun, and I mean the content's great. You should go and check some out if you don't know it already. We had a great chat covering all sorts of stuff. We've got a bit of stuff in common. We both started out as drummers, and both came to bluegrass a little bit later in life rather than being sort of brought up around it. But yeah, we cover all sorts of stuff, from the mistakes we all make to, you know, the bluegrass community. Talk a bit about Tony Rice and our favourite guitar breaks. Just a great chat. I had a wonderful time talking to him. He's a lovely guy, and I hope you enjoy listening as much as I enjoyed recording it. So here we go. Here's the interview with Marcel. So Marcel, thanks for joining me today. This is great. It's really good to talk to you. We have a thing in common. We both started out playing drums rather than guitar. And
Yeah, that's right.
It's a cool thing, and the one thing about learning drums first is it gives you rhythm that just sort of lives in your body, and it's just there, and you don't have to think about it, and it's a marvelous thing, isn't it?
I actually find it one of the harder things to teach, because it's something that I don't remember learning, how to count and how to feel rhythms. It's just, I feel like it's ingrained in me.
Yeah. My little boy's 8, and he's taking drum lessons, and he just wanders around playing drums on his body. And it's lovely to see, because he's not even thinking about it. But in later years, whatever he wants to play, that'll just be there for him.
That's it.
Cool. So I had a little bit of a read about you this afternoon. You grew up in South Phoenix on a farm. And it sounds to me like you spent a fair bit of time cutting your teeth playing in pit bands for musicals.
Yeah, that is very, very true. That was later. My family had moved to Washington State, and yeah, when I moved out, you know, my only marketable skill was music, sight reading, and musicals were a great place to take advantage of that, because they essentially want you to come in a couple weeks before the show and be able to read everything very quickly. You don't get as much rehearsal time as the actors, right? And so if you can't read fast, you know, there's no way you're going to memorize 80 songs, you know, 40 songs for each act. So you got to be able to read.
Yeah, and everything you're doing is to support something else. Like, you're never in the spotlight, so it's probably a pretty good exercise in listening and, like, backing people up, I guess.
And, you know, that's something they favor, too. They favor multi-instrumentalists, right? So if you play a little drums, a little guitar, a little piano, a little bass, well, they want you for the show, because depending on the song, there might be a little shuffling in the pit. You know, there's, like, 5 guys, you know, down there at max, more like 3 guys down there, all trying to cover all the parts at one time. And I got more jobs, you know, just saying, hey, I can play the bass parts and the guitar parts, depending on which song you want me to do them for, than anything else.
Yeah, I remember Brian Sutton saying something very similar about being a utility player. And he's obviously known as a guitarist, but he covers a fair few instruments, and he gets a lot of calls just to, you know, be the one guy with 4 or 5 things.
That's right.
So how did you sort of transition into bluegrass? Was it pretty early on in your life you got into it? How did you first hear it?
No, it was not early on in my life at all. Despite, you know, growing up on a farm, my family did not listen to any bluegrass. We did listen to a lot of acoustic music. We listened to a lot of, like, Jim Croce, a lot of James Taylor, a lot of Cat Stevens. Those are all artists that I grew up on. But it wasn't until I was already 19 or 20 that I started hearing bluegrass for the first time. And I lived with these guys that were kind of music snobs. They were music nerds, and they would always try to one up you. So, you know, for instance, if you said, "Hey, I really like, you know, Hound Dog. I like Elvis Presley." They'd be like, "Oh, you got to listen to, you know, Big Mama Thornton sing Hound Dog." You know, they'd throw it back and they'd throw it back and they'd throw it back. And eventually that happened with Bluegrass. I can't remember the tune, but yeah, someone was eventually, you know, like, "Hey, you got to listen to so-and-so's version of this. You know, it's like the authentic original." And I heard it and I was like, "Oh, what is this? I got to learn how to do this." And it just consumed my whole life.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the UK listening to the Beatles and Iron Maiden, and Bluegrass was not on my radar. But, you know, once it gets in your ear and you start digging in a bit, you can keep going forever, can't you?
That's right, that's right.
So, was it guitar that you sort of grabbed hold of first when you were learning Bluegrass? Was that your sort of first choice?
Yeah, at the time, you know, honestly, I was making more money in the musical scene playing drums and bass. Is what I got asked to play a lot more. But there were moments, there were productions like Grease, where I'd be asked to play guitar. I think we did a production of High School Musical where I played guitar as well. there would be, you know, a handful of productions where they'd ask me to play guitar, but most of the time it was drums and bass. And so when I found Bluegrass, it was kind of an excuse to play the instrument that I preferred. I wanted to play more guitar. And my other skill sets, you know, didn't transfer as well. I'm not going to play piano in a bluegrass band. I'm not going to play drums in a bluegrass band. I guess it has to be guitar. And honestly, I wasn't much of a lead guitar player either. I was mostly a rhythm guy. I mean, I could fake a lead here and there and, you know, play some pentatonic scales. But I wasn't known as a lead guitar player. So it took a lot of woodshedding for me to build that skill set to come off as a bluegrass guitar player.
It's probably a pretty cool way to have it around, though, isn't it? So many bluegrass players learn like lead and nothing else, and then they find themselves in a jam and you've got to play 95% backup. So if you can play the rhythm, that's got to be a good thing.
That's right. You know, a lot of players, you know, start with like you know, like their A minor pentatonic blues stuff first too, and I didn't have that experience. I never played blues. The only time I started working on my blues was after I was working on bluegrass. And I was like, oh, everyone else can play blues. I should work on that too.
And so you made the switch from kind of playing in pit bands into like then playing some bluegrass. And how did you then go from that into teaching?
Well, I really wanted to be a music teacher. And when I was playing in pit bands, it was essentially because I couldn't get into uni. I couldn't get accepted. And part of it had to do with the audition process and my hearing loss. And I just couldn't make that happen. And so I ended up, you know, calling up my friends and saying like, "Hey, what'd you learn today? You know, I'll give you $20. Come over to my house. Teach me what you learned at school." And so I was kind of getting my teaching and music education on the side secondhand. And so it made sense. Ultimately, what I wanted to do was teach music, and I just came at it from a weird angle, I guess.
Yeah. And I guess, like with music like bluegrass, so many people do learn it from other people rather than, you know, it's a social music and it's handed down and passed on, isn't it?
That's right. And I think it kind of had an effect on my approach, where I am kind of an analytical guy. If you watch my YouTube videos, I get into the theory.
I had spotted that, yeah.
And so I think it's because I was doing that. You know, I was getting this like secondhand theory education, and I'm applying it to bluegrass, a music that you're quote unquote not supposed to do that with. And I think it primed me to be a teacher, you know, of this genre.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's all useful stuff, isn't it? I think people, there's sort of two schools of thought with theory and with learning, and some people have this misconception that if you learn more stuff, it's going to somehow hamper your creativity and your authenticity. And it's like it's speaking a language, you can know thousands and thousands of words, but you can still choose to say something really blunt and simple when you want to as well.
That's right. Yeah. You know, you can always just turn that switch off. And honestly, when I'm playing shows, that switch is always off. you know, when I'm sitting down with other people playing, my theory brain isn't on. I like your language metaphor. Perhaps the word comfortable, and everyone says comfortable, is a good example.
Yeah.
You can pronounce it correctly, but you normally don't, I bet.
Yeah, and we all know loads of clever words, but we tend to use the same ones over and over again because they connect with other people. And music, like, you know, you can take the metaphor too far, but music as a language and music as a conversation is about communication more than anything. Rather than, well,
yeah,
it should be. For some people, it's about showing you what they know, but for most people, it's a conversation, and you want somebody to hear you and understand you.
Yeah, you're potentially missing the point if you're not communicating.
Yeah, totally. And it's, you know, I think there was something, I can't remember which of your videos it was on, it might have even been the Ask Me Anything video that you put up, but it's like you made this point about people asking you how to improvise and how to create variations, and your point was that when you start out, successful variations are more important than cool variations. And it's that idea of just being able to participate in the conversation and keep the conversation. I guess it's like playing tennis. You need to get the ball back before you start hitting winners, because if you don't get the ball back, you're not in the game.
That's right. Yeah, and when I think about when I was going to my first bluegrass jams and playing with other people, that's what it was all about for me. I was thinking, hey, can I get to the end of my break? can I finish my break? Rather than, will it be a cool break or a novel break? Like, can I just do it?
Yeah.
And sometimes I didn't. But sometimes I did.
And sometimes we all don't. And that's part of the learning process, isn't it? Is learning what to do when you don't. And I think that's one of the hardest things for people who are learning sometimes, I think, is that idea of getting from being a player to being an improviser. And it's a whole skill set, isn't it? And it takes time, and it's, you know, we're all, most of us still on that journey. I'm you know, it's a daily thing for me working out how to do that. But it's something that you do and can teach. So you have videos that show people how to take the concepts of improvising, starting from, I don't know, maybe just having a constant stream of notes through to how you structure things. And we'll be right back with you just after this. Collings Guitars has been a long-time supporter of the bluegrass community, from collaborating with artists to sponsoring festivals big and small, and now by sponsoring Bluegrass Jam Along. Handmade in Austin, Texas, every Collings guitar and mandolin that leaves the shop is built from the sound up, and the team loves seeing a Collings in the hands of players of all levels, from local musicians to world-renowned pickers. Visit collingsguitars.com for more. This episode is also brought to you by Peghead Nation, the home of roots music instruction. With 65 streaming video courses for guitar, mandolin, banjo, fiddle, dobro, bass and ukulele from some of the leading names in acoustic music, Peghead Nation has something for every picker. You'll learn the tunes and techniques you need to join in at jams and play the music you love, plus advanced techniques like improvisation, theory and ear training. Your first course is just $20 per month, and you can add more for $10 a month. Sign up for any course and get your first month free with the promo code JAMALONG, all one word. Join thousands of other players, including me, who are advancing on their instruments and having more fun playing the roots music they love at pegheadnation.com.
Yeah, there's it's a weird thing too. I find that a lot of people, let's say adults, a lot of adults are concerned about the quality of the things that they improvise, and so they shoot themselves in the foot before they ever even get started. You know, if you have a phrase and you want to create a derivative version of it, you want to create a new version of this phrase that has all the same components, you can't be worried about the quality of all the derivative versions. You just have to pump out all the derivatives. That's much more important than thinking, hey, is this going to be good? You can really stalemate yourself and not get anywhere.
Yeah, and sometimes, as with conversational language, the things you find you like most are things you said that you weren't planning to. And they come out and you hear them and go, oh, that's cool. Oh, I better remember that.
Yeah, that's right. I'd much rather find ideas like that, you know, just like a casual inspiration, like, oh, wasn't that unique, rather than sitting down and composing, right? And saying, what if I moved this note here? What if that was this? And what if this happened instead? That's less interesting to me than the in the moment, you know, inspiration.
Yeah. And I think that's a really interesting point about, like, particularly like adults getting in their own way a bit too much. And I do that, you know. I'm not brought up in the bluegrass tradition. I'm not even, you know, brought up in the US. And so for me, my sort of little internal monologue is always, oh, you don't sound bluegrass enough. You don't sound bluegrass enough. And actually, I sound like me, like channeling a bit of bluegrass and a bit of other stuff. And the idea is to find your sound. But I'm constantly just listening to myself playing, going, that's not bluegrass enough. That's not bluegrass enough. And we can easily trip ourselves up before we even get the guitar out of the case, can't we?
That's a really interesting thing that you bring up. I feel that way too. I felt that way for a lot of my bluegrass journey, and I've always considered the greatest compliment I can receive is authenticity. When people say things like "you're the real deal," or "you sound authentic," "you sound like, you know, my grandfather used to play," when people say those things to me, it makes me want to cry. I'm like, you know, I finally feel validated in some way. Like, oh, I finally made it somewhere in this tradition. They don't even have to be other musicians. It's just other people that say it sounds real. It makes me happy.
I think it's that part of that human desire to belong, isn't it? I mean, part of the reason I do this podcast is I'm so disconnected from so much of what goes on in the world of bluegrass. Like, this is an opportunity for me to be part of it as well. And I think it's that, you know, we all want to fit in, we want to belong, we want to be part of something. And bluegrass particularly is the kind of music you can be part of. It's not about being cool and being on the outside. It's, you know, it throws its arms wide and says, come on in.
You know, we were just talking, I did a live stream right before we talked. And on the live stream, I was talking with my chat, and we ended up talking about this event I used to run. It was called Marcel's Bluegrass Night. And it was a local stage jam, right? You'd have to get on stage and play into microphones, but it was essentially a jam. It's unrehearsed. And I started that event before I had any right to start that event. I started that right as a maybe, you know, high-tier amateur. And the reason why I started it was because I wanted all the local bluegrass musicians to come out and to school me. You know, I wanted to get... I wanted to fall face down in the mud and be like, oh, I don't know that tune, but we're going to play it anyway. Or, oh, I really didn't do good on that break, but give me another one. You know, I wanted to keep having that that struggle. And it was other musicians bringing new material to the table that would do that. So I essentially created my own forum and invited everyone to come teach me under the guise of this public event.
Yeah, and that's great. I mean, you know, the times you learn stuff are when you're not the smartest person in the room, or you don't know the most in the room, and you listen. You know, that's how we get stuff, isn't it? That's how more stuff comes in.
It's the opposite of being drunk. You don't want to be the drunkest person in the room. But you do want to be, you know, the less talented player in the room.
Yeah, totally, totally. And because otherwise, you're not, you know, you're not learning anything. So do you find, because obviously, you know, you teach lessons on Skype and Zoom as well as teaching via YouTube, and that's very much a two-way thing. How do you find with the YouTube? Is it, I guess, the community sense of it and doing the live streams and hearing from people and getting the feedback? Is that what sort of keeps it two-way?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing making content for YouTube. I think the best piece of advice I ever got, and, you know, what finally made it click to me, was that you have to you have to personify your audience. You know, you might have maybe a guitar channel where you're talking and you think, hey, my audience is this complete beginner. You might even name them. My audience is Tom. Tom has held a guitar for 30 seconds in his life, and I'm going to help him. And so my audience is, you know, like this Dave character. Dave's, you know, maybe in his 30s, 40s, you know, he might have a couple kids. He's played guitar before. He knows a little bit of theory, but, you know, he's ready to get serious about bluegrass. That's my audience. Yeah. And now I know whenever I make a video, like, I'm talking to Dave.
It's classic sort of marketing persona rules, isn't it? Is, you know, try and talk to a person rather than talk to everybody. Because if you can get that right and it clicks, then YouTube and podcasts are very personal, intimate, one-on-one kind of thing, so you can really do that. And like I said, I started this podcast thinking in lockdown, it was going to be for people who couldn't get out to go to a jam, and they'd have something to jam along with at home. And actually turns out that a big bit of it is people who haven't got the confidence to do that yet anyway, and they're sitting at home playing along with these podcast tracks as a way of trying to build up the confidence, because it's terrifying, that first thing of going, I can play four tunes, but how do I sit in a room with people and play them probably slightly faster than I know how to, and, you know, with all the jitters and all the nerves, and it's, you know, getting out and playing with other people is where it all becomes real, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't want to give the advice that everyone gives, but, you know, let me just say that all of those people at that jam have all fallen on their face too. They've all been in that circumstance where this is very difficult. It's an uphill battle, and they're trying to figure out how to improvise or how to play that quickly or whatever quality you're talking about. So when you go in and you bare your belly, you know, you show that you're struggling with this thing too. There's not going to be hatred for you. They're not going to look down upon you. They're going to remember, hey, I remember what it was like to be that guy. And most of the time they help you. When I think about positive and negative jam experiences that I've had, you know, as different levels of a player, as I've grown, they've been overwhelmingly positive. Overwhelmingly positive. There's so many people that have come up to me and said, like, hey, I like what you were trying to do, but maybe that's not the kind of tune that you would do that in. And as a beginning player, like, that was wonderful information to hear. Thank you so much for telling me that, you know?
Yeah. And I think you often get at a jam, you get the sort of breaks that get the most response are often people who are having a go and not quite getting there, rather than the people who are really nailing it, because people want to encourage them. They want them to, you know, be there in a year's time playing something new.
That's right. I tell this story all the time, but there's one break that's burned into my brain that I played. And I was playing guitar for kind of a bluegrass singer-songwriter in town. We were playing at a local brewery. And I was playing this break over some kind of non-traditional chord changes. And I was kind of struggling. I worked myself into a weird corner, you know, and I had to get out. And I kind of sweat through it. I was like, when it was over, you know, I wiped my forehead and, you know, thank God it worked out. And the audience just erupted. Everyone clapped. And it was like this click in my head. I was like, oh, they saw my whole journey. They saw me sweat and they liked it.
Yeah. People like this idea that, you know, I think definitely with bluegrass, it's a down to earth sort of thing. And if you go to a festival, you can meet the people you've just seen on the stage, or they'll be doing a workshop in a little tent around the corner, or there isn't that sense of there are rock gods and there are audience, and the audience will never be the rock gods. It's like we're all just the same people at different stages on the same journey, almost. Like, most of us will never get as far as Billy Strings or Chris Thiele, but we are essentially on the same journey and we can somehow relate to that.
That's true. That's exactly right. It's also a funny dynamic. I mean, at least here in the States, when you go to a bluegrass festival, there'll be people that know so much about the artists on stage. You know, I've been in an audience and seen someone playing on stage. They're playing a new song on an album they just put out, and the guy next to me says, "I played that lick on the last record," and that's remarkable. I mean, how many concerts could you go to and have someone just so knowledgeable that immediately calls out, "Hey, that was the thing you played on the last record." You know, the audience is almost like, whether or not the audience has made it to that level, they're kind of pushing the bands to experiment and to go further as well.
And it's got to be one of the genres of music where, like, a high proportion of people in the audience are also instrumental players themselves. They must, you know, compared to the average rock group, there'll be a lot of people who want to be, but...
I mean, when you're at a bluegrass festival here in the States, it's kind of weird to meet someone who doesn't play or doesn't have a family member that plays. You know, if you're just standing in a crowd of people, you could turn to the person to your left and say, "Hey, what do you play?" And they're like, "Oh, I play mandolin." You know, that's why they're there. They're also a player. It's rare to meet someone who's just a fan, which maybe reflects poorly on the genre, but it's true.
No, I don't know. I think it reflects really well on the genre. It sort of feels like everybody's part of it. I think that's got to be a good thing. So I guess, like, one of the things this brings up with teaching and encouragement and just how people get through all this stuff, what are the things that you've learned, particularly from the last 6 or so years of doing lessons with Marcel, about how people learn and how to convey musical ideas and help people through some of that stuff. Is there a difference? There must be quite a big difference between how you teach an individual on a Skype lesson versus how you construct some content that's going to be seen by, you know, tens of thousands of people.
That's right. Yeah, it's a pretty broad net that you cast when you make a YouTube video, and you'll never satisfy everyone. But one-to-one, when I'm talking with people, I find that a lot of our conversations revolve around how you hold things in your mind, like how you balance all the things that you have to be thinking about. There's a great example I have. There's a student I have who's blind. His name is Justin. And he's an excellent player. He has a great ear. And whenever we talk, I can't give him tab. I can't give him sheet music. I can't give him lesson materials, right? He has to hold it in his brain. And so a lot of our lessons end up being this conversation about how you think about it rather than how you might play it, which is interesting. An example maybe for the people at home is how you view chord changes in your head. So a lot of people think about songs and they think like, hey, it's kind of a long G chord, and maybe there's a short C chord, there's a longer G chord again, maybe there's an F. I'm describing Red Haired Boy. you know, you might play it out in your head like that. And I find that that's not very useful to when you start carrying around more and more tunes. It's not a very useful way to think about it. Well, yeah. You know, imagining, well, it's kind of a long chord, it's kind of a short chord. Eventually that breaks down. So one easy way to hold that information in your brain is to imagine four boxes. You have four boxes, you have four boxes, four boxes, just stacked vertically up and down in your brain. And you just drop the chords into those slots of where they appear. And that tends to help people much better than anything else. If you're not already visualizing chord progressions like that, like for instance, let's do one. If I had to do like Rolling in My Sweet Baby's Arms, my first row would all be G, 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 G. My second row would be G, G, D, D. My third row would be G, G, C, C. My last row would be D, D, G, G. That makes it so much easier for me to carry around a million tunes. But people don't think about that. I see tons of players that are just like, yeah, Rolling in My Sweet Baby's Arms, kind of a long G chord, and eventually it goes to a D.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because like, I was thinking about that. For the podcast, I put chord sheets up for all the tunes on the website, and I started off putting them up as kind of writing them out that way and writing, you know, sticking the bars in, and then sort of G slash 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 C slash slash slash. And then somebody said, can you also put them up in the national number system? Because I'm a banjo player and I want to be able to move things around a bit. And then you do that and you put the number every beat. You don't put it once in the bar, three slashes. You put 1-1-1-1-5-5-5-5 or whatever. And it's just super clear, isn't it?
It is. It's really clear. The natural number system is also a great one too. If you're looking for a way to think about that in your head, folks at home, I would count on my fingers. So if you start on your thumb and you put your root chord there, for instance, if it's G, you just go through your musical alphabet, G, A, B, C, D. You have G, C, and D on your thumb, your ring finger, and your pinky or your little finger. And the interesting thing is that for all the keys in bluegrass, you won't get any trouble with any sharps or flats. It'll always work out because we don't play any of those chords. So, you know, for G, C, D, you know, E, A, it's always going to work out. That's a quick way to do that math if you don't already have a way to do it.
Yeah, it's cool. And I think that's it. I think like there's so much material out there now. If you want to learn to play guitar, there's no shortage of resources. But teaching is maybe a little bit about curating some of that and describing the ideas. Like you say, it's not anybody can tell you what the notes are, but it's giving people a way to hold that in their head in a way that makes sense to them. And also particularly with the one-on-one stuff, I'm an artist work student. I get lessons from Brian Sutton, and I signed up for it, you know, thinking, yeah, it's all going to be about licks and flash stuff. And, you know, nearly all of it is about creating a good sound, creating good tone, making music that sounds good to people, and layering the rest of the stuff on top of it. And that's the stuff that I never would have got watching, you know, going through my tab books or watching DVDs in the old days, or, you know, somebody to present it to you. Like, I mean, and you can do that on YouTube as well, but distill the ideas and present them rather than just here's the material. It makes such a difference.
You know, the tone thing, I love that you bring that up. You know, not enough people talk about that. I don't talk about that enough. I think mostly because I'm trying to give people the courage, like you, to go out and jam and be part of the community. But the actual tonal production of your instrument is a huge deal. And it's actually one of the things that creates like a night and day difference when you're playing with other people. I notice, for instance, I was just at my like guitar repairman guy, my luthier. His name is Jeff Huffman. He makes great guitars. I was at Jeff Huffman's place, and my friend Alan Barnosky, who writes for Acoustic Guitar Magazine, was also there. So the three of us, all guitar players, were sitting down playing. And, you know, me and Alan are playing our hot licks and doing our cool things. And Jeff's tone was just so much better than ours. And no matter what guitar he was playing, I couldn't help but just hear how good his tonal production was. And, you know, Jeff has been playing forever. He's got stories about meeting Tony Rice in the 70s and all that. But, you know, no matter what Jeff played, it sounded better than what I played because his tone was so good. It's funny.
Yeah, and I years ago, I had a short stint at trying to be a steel guitar player. And I had a few lessons from a British steel player called BJ Cole, who is incredible. And he'd sit down on my sort of 600-pound starter pedal steel and make it sound like the best instrument in the world, and I would sit down at his best instrument in the world pedal steel and make it sound like a 600 pound starter guitar. And it's, you know, and that's an electric instrument, it's not an acoustic instrument, but like the tone, people just, you know, I think a good player, you can give them pretty much any instrument and they can sound like themselves on it.
That's right. Yeah, it's kind of a funny trap for beginner players to fall into. You know, everyone's talking about which guitar should I buy, you know, what kind of this do I need, what kind of that do I need, when it's to some extent kind of not about that, right? If you're doing everything correctly, you can get a great sound out of most instruments. Now, if you have a 300-year-old guitar with super high action and everything, yes, by all means, go get a new guitar. But if you have something that's workable, you could probably, you know, work through that struggle a little bit and get a good sound out of that instrument. It's hard to buy a bad guitar nowadays.
Do you know, it really is. My guitar is an Eastman, and it cost me £370 secondhand, and it sounds incredible. It's, yeah. You know, and you think back to the first guitars I owned, and they used to physically injure me. And this is, you know, it's a really well put together guitar that's got a great sound, and it's, you know, it's a cheap guitar, really. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. That's one very nice thing about starting to play now. If you go out and get an instrument, it's gonna play better than, you know, even what people, you know, 20 years ago had to start on.
Yeah,
guitars,
yeah,
nowadays they all play well.
They do, and I've heard a couple of people say in recent weeks, things I've read and things I've been watching, that actually if most people invested more money in lessons and less money in gear and trying different picks every week and trying different strings every week, get a decent pick, get a decent guitar, get some decent strings, and then spend your money on a teacher.
It's funny to me that a lot of the equipment too in bluegrass, it boils down to like one or two choices. I mean, admittedly, a lot of them are expensive choices, but, you know, we can say blanket statement, lots of people like Martin guitars. Stay blanket statement, everyone's playing a Blue Chip or a Wigan. You know, for capos, everyone likes the Elliott capos. I know those are all expensive things. They aren't, you know, super affordable, but the equipment question, it's kind of already been answered. We know what equipment is. We all kind of use the same equipment, you know?
Well, so with that in mind, what do you play? What's your sort of, do you have a main guitar or do you tend to move between a few?
I do. So when I'm playing for videos and stuff, I tend to play this guy. I'm showing you, the people at home can't see, but it's a 1967 Martin D35. It's actually my friend's grandfather's. Belongs to Grandpa Arthur.
Cool.
Grandpa Arthur has sort of lent it to me on indefinite loan. The family will never sell it to me, but it's just become mine. I've tried.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's a lovely guitar. It's not my gigging guitar, but I play it all the time. My gigging guitar
sounds good.
My gigging guitar is a Martin DC Aura. It's a very weird model, but it's got the Aura pickup system in it, which I really enjoy. It's got a compressor built in. It's got the EQ built in. It's got a bunch of different microphone images built in, so I can cycle through different sounds on the fly. It's a wonderful guitar.
And does it have a cutaway as well?
Yeah, that's the one with the cutaway. That's it.
Yeah, yeah. Do you get a bit of stick for playing a cutaway guitar and playing bluegrass? Because people can be very traditional about these things.
I definitely do. You know what? Everyone backs off when I tell them the story about how I got that guitar. So I'll tell you. I had a gig coming up. I think it was a wedding gig. A gig coming up, and my Martin that I had at the time, the top and the back were separating from the sides. So I was getting this natural distortion, you know, this rattling sound. And so I had to get a new guitar. And so in my desperation, I'm going to all the guitar stores looking for something. And I finally found, at a Guitar Center of all places, I found this beautiful Martin. Of course, it had the cutaway, but I loved the way it sounded. And I looked at the tag, and I was like, I don't think that's what this guitar is. And then I look in at the, you know, the neck block, and it says custom. It's from the custom shop. And so I realized that this guitar is labeled incorrectly, and they're selling it for a price that's a couple thousand dollars less than what it should be.
Wow.
And so I went up, and I was like, yeah, I'll take this one. And the guy went into the back, and he's like, you know, it's so weird. I'm looking at the tag, and I can't find the case that goes with it. And I said, oh, it doesn't matter. Give me any case. Any case will be fine. And they sold it to me. I walked out the door. And so, yeah, I get a little bit of guff from people saying that, you know, you shouldn't play guitar with a cutaway. But when they hear that I got it, you know, for 60% off, they understand.
Well, and people will tell you shouldn't play an Ovation until you point out that Tony Rice used to play one.
That's right. I love that.
It crops up every now and again on the Facebook groups, and people's incredulity that, you know, Tony Rice played an Ovation and sounded like Tony Rice.
You know, they really like the sounds of those Ovations. When you talk to them, they treat it almost like it's a like it's its own instrument. You know, it's kind of a different sound. And I think part of it has to do with the like mixing when they were recording those albums. So they did a lot of Manzanita, I think Manzanita has played on an Ovation guitar. But depending on the mix that you're trying to get, the Ovations tend to be a little less boomier than a Martin. So it's almost like this thing has already been low cut. You know, so if you go into the recording studio, you want your lead to cut more, you want some of the bass taken out of your instrument, the Ovation already does that. Or say you have a really active bass player and you want to play your rhythm part and you don't want the low frequencies of the guitar to mix with the bass, maybe grab the Ovation. Maybe that would be good for the rhythm part.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's kind of how they used it, you know? It, like, did a different job.
I mean, I guess, you know, particularly if you're playing with more than one guitar and everybody's got a D28, they're all going to occupy the same sort of space. So if you've got something that's got a different voice, it's going to shine out a bit.
That's right. Yeah, it's a weird thing to think about because Ovations are an eternal joke now. But yeah, they really like those things.
Yeah, yeah. So, talking to Tony Rice, I guess, brings me on to, you've transcribed a whole load of Tony's licks and breaks, and a whole load of other people. I mean, you've probably lost count of how many solos you've transcribed now. Do you have a favorite bluegrass guitar break of all time?
Man, that's a hard question.
I can give you a minute to think about it, and I'll tell you my answer if you like.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I was going to give you a bit of thinking time, but both my favorite guitar break and my favorite mandolin break are on the same tune, and it's Tony Rice's I've Waited As Long As I Can. I just think the solo on that is just brilliant. It's got a bit of all the things that make Tony Tony.
Is I've Waited As Long As I Can, is that on Plays and Sings? Plays and Sings Bluegrass?
Is it? That's a good question, because I first heard it on a compilation, so I get confused, because I always hear something else after it in my head. And I get lost as to which album it's on. But yeah, it's just got the best solo.
The only reason I bring it up, and I might be wrong, you know, people can look it up, but the album, Plays and Sings Bluegrass, Tony plays a lot of weird stuff, despite it being like a, you know, him playing traditional bluegrass on that record. that record has a lot of like bizarre Tony licks on it. So it's kind of a lot of people's favorite. I know it's Trey Hensley's favorite bluegrass record. It's one of mine too. I was going to say that one of my favorite Tony breaks is on the tune Shadows. There's this really, really beautiful thing that he does right at the beginning of the break. And I, maybe one of the reasons I like it so much is it kind of confounds me to like put it on paper. The very first three notes are almost like a quarter note triplet starting off the beat. It's this very like, it kind of just washes over you. It's like this waterfall effect as the break starts, and it's just gorgeous. It's beautiful. And if anything, it just shows like how interesting his time is. Like the feel on the beginning of that break is just remarkable. And he plays all kinds of just gorgeous, beautiful things on that. It's lovely. It's not a hot break by any means. It's just a beautiful break.
Oh, I'm going to have to go back and listen to that. I'm going to stick a link to that track in the show notes so people can go and listen to it too. Yeah. I think it's the thing with, you know, listen to Tony Rice and the time, because everything feels so raw, like everything was a choice that no other choice could have possibly been made. It all sounds so in its place that you, like, sometimes you don't even think about the time because it's just so lyrical and fluid. Or even when he's playing quickly and he's playing hard, it's just like the time is incredible.
It's kind of like when artists play with proportions of items. And they can give you a really interesting perspective on something by playing with proportion. But if you sit and think about it, you know that that's not what the item or the person actually looks like. You know, they talk about like the Statue of David, how like the hands are much larger than they should be. But yeah. When you're looking up at it, it all makes sense, right? It feels very proportional. And that's kind of what Tony's rhythm does. It kind of ebbs and flows. Sometimes he's rushing and sometimes he's laying back. And it's more than just playing in time. He's playing around the beat in such a nice way that can just be gorgeous.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that that I sort of picked up most listening to a lot of the tributes to Tony and the various sort of conversations on Facebook and the various things. But like the amount of people who mentioned his rhythm playing more than his lead playing. And the transitions between his lead and rhythm as well, and just sort of that sense that the same way people talk about Placido Domingo on an opera stage is that he just ups everybody else's game by 50% just by being there and doing what he does. Yeah. Just brings more out of everybody else as well. And that's a beautiful thing to hear about a musician.
There's a great little like Q&A that's on YouTube. So someone with like a handheld video camera in the 90s, and maybe Tony had just given a workshop or something, but they're asking him candidly a couple questions. And I believe they ask him to demonstrate some rhythm. And he says, "Oh, I can't do that without a band here." And I thought that was such an interesting statement for him to make. And I feel the same way now that I think about it. Like, I can teach you some basics of rhythm. I can show you lots of different things that people do. But rhythm is a reactionary element. It has to have other people for it to like sort of do what it's supposed to do. It's hard to do in a vacuum. So it's funny the thing that Tony's most known for this thing, and someone's like, you know, "Hey, can you demo some of your excellent rhythm?" And he's like, "I can't do it unless there's so many people playing that it's hard to hear."
It's true, and you put it like that, and I think it is really interesting because people think about rhythm as being right or not. You're either on the beat and in time, or you're not on the beat and not in time. And I guess at first when you're learning to play, that's sort of an element of it, and you just have to learn to lock in. But once you've got it, you can wander wherever you want with it, as long as you know what you're doing.
That's right.
And that's what adds tension and feel and groove. You know, even sort of, you go and watch a musician like Josh Ritter live, and like what Josh Ritter does live is just channels energy. You know, he's not a bluegrass player, but he always, nearly every song will speed up at some point because he's just getting excited and taking you with him. And Doc Watson, like you hear the amount of guitar duets you hear Doc Watson play, and when he comes in, it all speeds up a little bit because he's just pushing it forward, and it's great. You know, you don't sit there going, "Oh, that's not in time." You sit there going, "Oh, this is great. I'm going with this."
I love that feeling, man. Yeah, I love specifically mandolin players out there. I love when mandolin players play a little bit ahead of the beat. It makes everything feel so good. When I'm using jam tracks, maybe the people watching know I'm a fan of Strum Machine, but when I'm using jam tracks, if they allow me to shift where things are on the beat, a lot of times I'll, you know, maybe push that bass forward a little bit, or that mandolin forward a little bit. So that way it always feels like it's rushing, whether it actually is or not. You know, it feels like it's pushing ahead. It's a great feeling.
And it's one of the thing, when I started doing this podcast, I was very conscious of the fact that there's lots of like better equipped people to do it than me, in terms of there's many better guitarists out there than me. But what I realized was that because it, like, it is me and I'm playing and my rhythm is not perfect, that somebody jamming along is actually jamming along with an actual person playing, and that you've got to be able to do. And I'm not saying my rhythm's all over the place, it's pretty good, but it's not kind of, if you line it up with a metronome, it's not all going to line up. And that's part of it, isn't it, is learning to, for music to breathe and play with other people to their internal clocks as well.
I remember I remember wanting to make this video. It's a longer video I made about cross-picking. And I kind of go into the history and talk about George Scheffler, and I interview some people that are sort of experts in that kind of playing. It's kind of a little bit of a different kind of video for me. And I remember when I was going to make it, I was talking to my friend Mickey. Mickey Abraham is one of the other teachers sort of on the Lessons with Marcel team. And I told him, you know, I don't think I'm the person to make this video. There's probably someone who knows more that should make it. And Mickey told me, he was like, well, you're the guy, you know, everyone, you're the one who started this thing, so you got to be the guy. And he was like, what better way to make this video than to be the person that doesn't know everything about it? Cause you get to actually, you know, research it and learn it as you go. I think that's true for what you're doing here too. I mean, you're trying to help people that are trying to get into this jam scene and trying to get into this music. Well, you're also, you know, getting better and better at the music. It's great. You're exposing the journey while you're, you know, leading everyone. I think it's a great way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely true. I mean, I can't tell you how much better my rhythm playing's got since I've had to be able to produce a track every week, you know, often having to learn the tune. And, you know, I would have spent all that time learning the melody and actually having to sit and make sure the rhythm playing's there. It's made such a difference to me. It's been great. It's not my own little accountability buddy. It's like having a teacher, you know, somebody to make sure you've done the work and check that you've done it.
You know, speaking of this rhythm playing, I find that when I'm recording music, that the rhythm guitar part is one of the things that, not only is it pretty quiet in the mix, it's one of the things that I keep iterating on. For instance, if I'm going to multi-track something, like I'm going to have everyone record separately, I'll record my rhythm track first and everyone tracks on top, and then I'll go back and I'll redo my rhythm part because now it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I found that with a podcast, I'll record the rhythm track, then I'll record the tune to the rhythm track, and then I end up putting them together as a performance track, and I'll often go back and re-record the rhythm track before I mix it.
Yeah, that's right. Because like we talked about, that rhythm is reactive, right? You're reacting to the situation, so it's hard to do in a vacuum.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I've loved this conversation. It's been a huge amount of fun for me. I'm going to presume that most people listen to this are going to know who you are, but for people who are new to Lessons with Marcel, the website and the YouTube channel, where's a good place for people to start? Because you've got so much content. Where's a good place to dive in?
Well, a great place to dive in is to go to the website, lessonswithmarcel.com. And if you navigate to the different pages on that website, we got a bunch of articles where you can learn about bluegrass guitar, some country guitar, some jazz. We got a videos tab too, where we post all the YouTube content back on the website. And of course, we have a bunch of transcriptions. They're all separated into beginning, intermediate, and advanced. And some of them are breaks exactly how they are on the album. Some of them are fiddle tunes that we've arranged for different skill levels. Of course, there you can sign up for Skype lessons. I mean, there's lots of things that you could do. The website is probably a good place to start, though.
Cool. So we'll put links to that in the show notes and make sure everybody can find all that as well. Is there anything else you've got coming up? Anything else you want to chat about or plug while you're here?
Well, I do want to say that I do live streams on YouTube every Tuesday. And we just changed the time. It's now 6 p.m. Eastern. So you got to do a little bit of time zone math potentially. But if you want to join us for a live stream, It's at 6 p.m. Eastern on Tuesdays. And mostly what it is us taking suggestions from the chat on what we want to transcribe. So it's a good opportunity for people who have a favorite break or a favorite recording, whether, you know, it's an entire break or just a little snippet that you want to understand or you want to hear me talk about. I'll pull up the recording and I'll write it down and I'll tell you what I think about it.
That's cool. I'll definitely be joining some of those. That's great. Well, thanks, Marcel. It's been a blast talking to you. I really enjoyed it.
No problem, man. Happy to be here.
Cool. I hope you enjoyed that. It was a lot of fun to record. I could have happily chatted to Marcel for twice as long as that. It's just super, super fun. If you want to find out more about any of the stuff we covered, go to the show notes and you'll have all the relevant bits and pieces there, links, details of how to find Marcel's platforms and all the stuff we talked about. But that'll be it. I'll be back next time with another tune. I will see you in the meantime and happy picking. Bluegrass Jamalong is proud to be sponsored by Collings Guitars and Mandolins, making some of the finest guitars and mandolins in the world since the 1970s. Visit collingsguitars.com and find out why.